I have short-term memory loss from all the drugs I've done all my life.
That I think that's the intro.
Over the centuries, the ruins of Nivea were covered in sand. Many years later, archaeologists found clay tablets with the words of the Assyrian kings. These words were like an ancient podcast blasting its message to the citizens of the future. The scribes were in ancient palaces, but I would like to think they brewed beer and had a shed near a lake known as Maspinock. I'm Mad Carl.
I'm Normal Andy.
I'm Producer Chris.
Welcome to the Art Shed. Crack a beer. Wait, oh, my beer didn't even crack, man. You guys did good, though. What was
that? That was my wine.
That was some cracking of wine, I think.
Yeah.
Who is this extra voice?
Should we
introduce
Costas in the shed?
So this week we're going to be talking to Shad Podgursky. Is that pronounced right?
Sean Podgursky.
Podgursky.
Yeah. Nice.
Jean-Claude Van Damme Gursky.
Yes.
Jean-Claude Podgursky.
That's awesome. So, of course, we got on a roll before the podcast, and you were freaking talking about your band. Do you think you can pick up that story or start it again or whatever?
Yeah, I can pick it up. Where were we? Because it's the Halloween season, I want to offer this as a cautionary tale to all young people starting bands. Manage your expectations. That will come into play later. I know that may have sounded corny right now, but if I had managed my expectations, the world would be different. But where are we going to start?
Well, why don't you give us just a background of... So we're going to do music in this first one, then we're going to talk about food, because currently you own D-Men Tap in Avondale? That's it.
Yep.
Yeah.
And the Donerman Food Truck.
But we're going to start today talking about Sybaris, the band that you...
Yeah, let's do it.
So
I started out, I liked music when I was a kid, and I liked all kinds of music, and... always thought like it would be cool to make music, but I didn't have the most like artistic nurturing family. My family was great, you know, they were always there for me, but like they were more of a real working class Polish family, and guitar lessons and stuff like that were like my dad liked rock music, but he didn't consider it a musical instrument, like, oh, guitar, anyone can bang on a guitar, which he was right. But he wanted me to learn violin or accordion so I could play polka music. And like, so I literally had, like, I played violin for a year and a half when I was in fourth grade. But I started getting really into music, and I worked at McDonald's and saved my money. And I lived in a small town between Toledo and Cleveland. I would go to see rock shows in Cleveland and Detroit. And just got really, really into music. And then I went to college and I started hanging out with some dudes that also liked the same music as me, which at that time was like kind of the Depeche Mode, New Order, and a little bit like, then we started getting into industrial, like the Skinny Puppy and Ministry type stuff. And I went to college with these guys, and then I moved to Chicago, and I graduated before them, and then they started a band after I left. I was like, these motherfuckers started a band after I left. But then they all moved. They followed me and moved to Chicago. And then like we started a band, and that's where things got interesting because I didn't know how to play a musical instrument.
Nice.
That's always a good time to start a band.
Isn't it?
It is.
There's more to being in a band than playing a musical instrument.
I mean, that's totally punk.
That is punk. Yeah, like real punk, not like not even like Green Day, but even like, I mean, The Clash to me is post punk already. But like real punk was, it's the same. It's more like garage bands in the '60s,
right?
Exactly. But at that time in Chicago, Chicago was super, like, that's when they were emerging as like the big indie rock city, and math rock was a big thing. So you had a lot of these people that were like playing in like crazy 9/8 time signatures and stuff like that, and everyone was like crazy musicians. And then like I moved from industrial and new wave stuff to more of the like post rock. I started listening to Sonic Youth and bands like Polvo and June of 44 and all the Steve Albini adjacent stuff, a lot of Husker Du and Sugar. Like I just almost overnight switched into that stuff. So I, by default, they're like, here, you just like make noise. You be the guy who makes noise and like scream into the microphone because you're funny. And they have funny lyrics, and like we'll make a band.
All right, I'd say I'm gonna put you on the spot. Go over some of your funny lyrics. I mean, say, can you think of anything? Like, can you think of any like lyrics from the day?
Yeah, they're like, I still listen to this band once in a while, and I'll tell you, they're horrifically misogynistic. Like, a lot of it is like,
spit out some lyrics for us, man.
My girlfriend broke up with me, type shit.
Oh, hey.
Boy. They're cringy.
All right. Don't do it then.
One is, you waste my time, my precious time, with half-baked truths and fatty thighs.
Oh, God.
I mean, you can cook. I mean, it's almost like your next thing is you're cooking with the fatty thighs, you know, like make a good, you know.
Yeah.
You know what? I was talking about a capon.
Well, so these bands, is this like, in the 90s, what year are we?
This was probably around 1994. This was a bunch of dudes that I was like my college friends. The funny thing that happened was, what had happened was, it's like we kind of got somewhat popular.
Right.
We had a weird way of going about promoting ourselves. Like we had a lot of friends that were in graphic design. So we had really cool posters. We were what they called bar stars. Like we used to go out and drink. So we knew a lot of people, and people would come out just to see our band and say, oh, what's going to happen? So we had a draw. And we're not necessarily that good. And through time, I found out through people that were like, oh, we found out that a lot of people through a continuing thread on this story will be like, I found some things that like are kind of heartbreaking, like what people really thought about me and stuff. And one of the things was like, yeah, everybody thinks your band kind of sucks, but you bring people out.
were your shows like kind of like train wrecky? Like why were people?
Yeah, they were kind of train wrecky. Okay. I can send you some like clips of, there's a few like rare clips of it. But yeah, I talked a lot of shit to the audience. And
yeah.
But I mean, also we weren't that, like we got better.
Right.
And like we changed a lot of members. Like we went through bass players. We went through like four bass players. And like the more you play, the better you get and the more focused we got. And like we actually started becoming good and started like the drummer from Don Caballero like would come to our shows and stuff like that, like which was a big deal in Chicago in 1999.
Right.
There's something about like the late 90s that was freaking magic. Like it was such a great time, man.
Tell me about it.
You know? everything is like, I'm thinking like 97 to 99. Like that's it. It was like a great run. I have no idea why.
I watched that Woodstock 99 documentary. And have you seen that?
No.
It's worth a watch because they kind of talk about like the perfect storm of like what was going on in society at that time. And I watched it and I kind of felt like shit watching it because of my misogynistic lyrics and stuff like that. What it kind of boiled down to is like during the Clinton era, things were kind of good. Everybody had money in their pockets. There wasn't a lot of like social strife and stuff like that. So people were just bored. And like dudes were just like angry for anger's sake. And that's where we got like our Limp Bizkits, our Korns, and that whole like new metal movement. And even though we were like indie rock, like pretentious indie rock, I could see that kind of bled into what we were doing at the time, which is why I'm like not necessarily that proud of like what I was singing about at the time.
So the in the Matrix, it is like 1999 all the time, right? So
yes,
I mean now people are like, hey, freaking Zach. I mean, like there isn't a choice anymore. Like if you're in the Matrix, you're like, okay, you know, and you come out of the Matrix, you're like, put me back into the fucking Matrix. I'm going to take the blue fucking pill, right? Does that put you in the Matrix again? You're not taking the blue pill. Who's going to take the fucking blue pill? You know what I mean?
Blue pill keeps you in the world that we know it, right?
I think I'm assuming the blue pill keeps you in the freaking Matrix in 1999 forever. Yeah. I mean, is there a reason not to do that?
No, I don't want to go where I live in the slime tunnel with slime going up in my head. I want to get laid and drink and hang out with my friends.
And yeah. Listen to Limp Bizkit.
Yeah. It breaks shit.
You know, like, what the fuck? Like, yeah, please zap me into the fucking 1999 zone. I ain't fucking getting out of this. But wait, I can be whatever age I was in 1999. That's better than now.
Yep, I remember. So when the band was firing, when that band was firing on all gears, it was. I remember going to see the Matrix with the band. We smoked right. A bunch of weed and went and saw the Matrix and. We also went and saw like American Pie together, which is another movie you couldn't make these days.
I have a really weird experience, like about like you remember when Saving Private Ryan came out, but it was like in the late 90s, right? Or
yep. I know these movies by what girl I was dating at the time.
Well, this is weird. I went to Saving Private Ryan, right, with my friends, and there was like some random single girl sitting in Saving Private Ryan, and she was sitting two seats over from me, and she was definitely from another country, and she freaking, like in the middle of the movie, she like moved herself right next to me, and like we were on a date, and then started like whispering in my ear, like, what does kaput mean? And I'm like, I have no fucking idea. You know, like I didn't know how to explain it to her. You know, I'm like, wow, I'm like some random chick is hitting on me during Saving Private Ryan. It was awesome.
I'm sure everyone else in the movie.
Really, what happened? You're leaving me hanging here.
Yeah. Oh,
I don't think it really went anywhere. I was with my friends. I fucked it up, I think, somehow. But yeah, right. I think if I had any skills, I could have picked her up. Like, I think about it later. I'm like, yeah, it's some weird foreign chick. Like, she moved over and sat next to me like we were on a date. You know, like, it was so fucking weird.
I'm going to think about that tonight.
Yeah, yeah. She was like, like, I would want to go back in the Matrix just so I can, like redo that. You know, right. So I can, like, I'm like, I should have said this to the lady. You know, it was just too shocking. And it was Saving Private Ryan. It was like, you know what I mean? It was like.
It's not the sexiest movie of all time.
No.
It wasn't like Titanic, you know, like it just came out of nowhere, you know, like.
But even then, like, you know, movies aren't really social places in the sense that you get to know someone well at a movie.
Yeah.
Something that you do with someone that you know, or afterwards you go somewhere to have food or drinks together with someone. It's like paired with something that's actually getting to know someone. You don't go to a movie to be like, hey, let's talk through the whole movie.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, right. It was weird. Like in the middle of it, she just moved over two seats and like was like cuddling with me. It was like it's kinda cool, but it was Saving Private Ryan.
So cool.
Yeah, 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 right. Exactly. And my friends are like, what the fuck, girl? I'm like, I didn't do it, man. What happened?
We're talking about music.
Music's cool.
Wait. So your band, freaking, you were talking about like your tour. You were touring all the shitty.
Well, this towns. I toured a little with this. So this is still like my noise rock boy band.
Okay.
And we did tour some, and It was cool. It was a mess. We did a lot of, like, we partied hard, did drugs and stuff.
May I ask the so where what year is this? This is the night, still the late 90s,
this is
right?
Probably
so
98, 99, 2000.
So what drugs are you, is your band doing?
You name it. We did a lot of ecstasy and Molly.
I was going to say that.
But so here's part of our shtick. Part of our shtick was we were the only rock and rollers doing that. So
right.
We were like, we would get it from like chicks that we knew that were in the club scene. And then we would take Molly and go to like super precious indie rock shows. Like, and we were the guys on Molly at indie rock shows, which was like kind of unheard of.
Yeah, that is kind of weird.
Well, we like wore glitter. We were like kind of glammy. We painted our nails and wore glitter, and we used to go thrift store shopping and wear like, we kind of looked like T-Rex, but we were playing totally gnarly, like just the like gnarly math rock. We were changing up time signatures. So our drummer was really good. He was like a classically trained pianist that jumped on drums. So he knew. So we were doing all these time signature changes, and I'm like just playing one finger. Like, I'm playing one finger on this guitar string and trying to keep up with changes of rhythms and stuff like that. So we were doing all that kind of fancy stuff. We looked like we were sweet.
Are you guys like David Bowie looking or
something? Yeah, we were kind of David Bowie looking. Yeah. We would play like shows with like punk rock queer bands at the time. There was a band called $3 Bill that we would try to get on every one of our like gays a $3 Bill. And that was like a, and we're like still friends with those folks today. But it was like, yeah, we didn't give a fuck. We wanted to be like semi-controversial, but we were like kind of socially, we were a lot of us, two of us were social workers at the time. Like we worked in the social services and were very like progressive people.
That's
so
cool.
Even though we were horribly misogynistic, but back in 1998, it was just a different time.
So I'm going to correct you. The only way you knew you were misogynistic is because you were like so like in tune with everything, like that you realized, oh, I'm misogynistic. Everybody else didn't realize they were misogynistic.
I didn't realize I was misogynistic until I like listened to it like not too long ago, and I was like, holy shit, this is terrible.
Oh, nobody has tapes of themselves back then.
Yeah,
so.
No. You know how, Carl, when we started this podcast, we had a discussion about words that we used a lot growing up that we had to make sure we don't use on the podcast.
Yeah.
Because it's stuff that it's like, we know it's not a good word to say, and we don't normally use it. But if you start telling a story from that time period, then you fall back into language of that time period, and all of a sudden you're like, oh.
Or like people like back in the day in the 80s, like the thugs, like the jocks who like picked on everybody. They were like, everybody was cool with them. You know what I mean? Like they were. It was just how it was. But now I like looking like my kids, like those guys would have never gotten away with all that like asshole-ish shit. You know what
no.
I mean?
Yeah.
You know, like it's so different. Like, you know, I'm sorry.
My hometown was pretty small, but we were close enough to Toledo and Cleveland and Windsor, Ontario, that we had cool radio stations.
Nice.
And I remember hearing the first NXS album, Shabu Shaba, and I fucking loved it. And nice. But I made an NXS shirt. Like I had the album and I traced the cover of the album. I just took a t-shirt with a Sharpie and made it and like I got called the, I don't know, I don't want to say it out loud, but I got called the F word. Like, oh, and pushed and knocked down, like, what's Inks? F-A-G-G-O-D.
Yeah. Right.
Like by jocks and stuff like that. And then and then that was Shabu Shaba. And then 4 years later, Kick came out and everybody loved Need You Tonight. And then it was everyone's favorite band. And I was like literally livid pissed that like I got beat up for liking this band. And I had to make my own t-shirt stretched out over an album and got beat up and pushed and called derogatory names. And then like 4 years later, everybody loved Need You Tonight.
It was literally a 4-year period that everybody like because I had like long dreads and people like literally would go out of their way to like and I was like skinny. People would literally go out of their way to like try to fight me like all the time. And then like I got normal, like I cut my hair and whatever, like and went into society for a while. And then like 4 years later, everybody has like all these piercings and everybody's listening to Jane's Addiction and it's like everybody's totally cool. I'm like, what the fuck happened, man?
Is that maddening?
Yeah, it is. It's totally freaking maddening.
I still get pissed off about that. That's why I'm talking about it right now, because I'm still holding a grudge 30 years later.
I'm like, me too. I'm like, I couldn't, like, like 4 years later, like everybody's cool now, you know, like what the hell happened? Like, it was like literally a societal shift from 1988 to 1991. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It was crazy.
We could do a whole podcast on that alone. Like, it's to say, also, we could edit this out. Dungeons and Dragons is the same thing. What I went through with D&D, and now it's like the thing to be. And I'm like, well, shit, man. What I went through this so you guys could do what you're doing right now. And goth, like, you know, I went through goth. Oh, totally. Now there's just like, just, you know, really attractive people wearing black and heavy black eyeliner. I'm so goth. I'm goth. Like, girls wear like black sweatsuits to like, and black Lululemons to the gym. And they're like, I'm gym goth. I'm like, I got beat up.
Right.
And you would not have come to my rescue in 1980.
Right.
Right. Right.
So funny, man. It's so funny. So you said you toured Lowell?
Not with this band.
Oh, sorry. We don't have to go chronologically.
It was really, like, it was funny because back then touring was like, there was no GPS or anything. So like, we were touring. Yeah. We would go on like 1 week tours. We would blow all our vacation money. We didn't have a publicist or we didn't know what publicists were. We would just.
So where were you working? Where were you? We working.
I was a mental health counselor at a nursing home for the mentally ill.
Cool.
It was pretty cool. And like, I would take my week vacation, and then we would all take our week vacation, and then go do these tours that were like, it would be like a Friday through a Sunday. Did that about 3 times. They were complete disasters. They were like just hanging out with your friends, getting into adventures and meeting girls and partying. And they really didn't get anywhere, but we did meet some people. And like, we played a show that like we coincidentally were on with a pretty big band at the time. And they really liked us. And then they ended up record, like the one of the members of the band recorded our album, our last album, which was just one of those like fall ass backwards in the shit. But at that time, like, our drummer, the guy who played piano, he was pretty good at drums. Our guitar player, he was pretty crafty at his stuff. We got a bass player that later on played in the biggest band I was ever in. He played bass, and then the hack, me, on like vocals, yelling and screaming and taking one finger and making noise with his pedals. And it worked. But we kind of like were partying too hard, and we ran out of ideas, and like we just were like, should we just stop? And we just kind of stopped.
Did you have any like projectors and weird like effects? If you guys are all on Molly, wouldn't you have something like that? Or?
So the next band. So fast forward to, we broke up in July of 2001 was our last show. After 9/11 happened, like, which was a thing, like that was kind of a big, there was a big cultural shift. Like, I wasn't in a band. My girlfriend had broken up with me. I was kind of like had no identity at the time. I quit drinking for a month to just try to get my shit together and focus. And this guy that was a fan of my band was like, hey, I need a bass player. With me and this guy are playing drums. And would you like to play bass? I'm like, I've never played bass, but like, sure. Like, seems like it would be a lot easier than playing guitar. And so I started playing bass with these guys, and they had some really, really great songs like that were the root of them were there. And then like 9/11 happened, and everyone was just kind of snuggling with one another, and things became more crafty. And we recruited this girl, Julie, who was like a totally awesome musician. She wanted to be in a band, but like didn't know where to begin. And we like, we had mutual friends, so she joined us. And yes, I had my friend Tony Kern, who now lives in Singapore. He directs films in Singapore. We made an EP, and we made a film to go with it that was projected behind us. So the whole, like, we all like kind of like Pink Floyd, especially like the early Pink Floyd. Our mutual favorite song was Fearless off of
awesome.
Fearless is like the greatest song ever. So we did a concept album, which was about a guy whose grandfather was dying. And so he was sitting in his grandfather's bed, but he had just got dumped by his girlfriend he got busted cheating. So he was watching his grandfather die, and all he could think about was how he got dumped for cheating. And his grandfather's like last memories and his melded together. So it's like this weird, and like, so we used all this old footage and modern footage, and the songs were about, I still kind of had my stupid misogynistic lyrics, but we had a girl in the band, so they kind of got toned down. And that was like Jim DeRogatis of the Sun Times was like, wow, this is like some of the best shit I've heard in a long time. And it was like, so we made that album, and like we got some, but it was such a production to do it.
Yeah.
That it was hard to like pull off doing it. And then we went on a tour, and the Julie, she didn't like touring at all. Like, so that stopped. And then this is where Sybaris comes in, is we're like, well, I swore off playing in a band with dudes ever again. I'm like, I'm not going to play in a band unless there's a chick in the band. Hard stop.
Totally.
Because I didn't like what it was making me. I didn't like the farts. There's so much farts.
Yeah.
Were you guys like in a van driving to the next show and everybody's farting or something?
Yeah. Just farts and like chicks and like, everyone likes chicks, but like it just got to be too much.
Yeah.
So I'm like, you know,
I hear you.
I want to like have a chick in the band, and that way it will calm us down, and we could help us focus, and we could concentrate more on the music.
Women are so civilizing.
They are civilizing, and I want to say, like, despite my misogynistic lyrics, like I'm very like the female energy is amazing. Women are amazing. Their energy is great. The way they think different and have a different rationale than males. And I think that we work together great.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
So I hope that doesn't sound weird or like I'm pandering or anything, but
no, I mean, it sounds weird, but I mean, everything in the shed sounds weird, man. I'm just joking.
It's the first rule about the
I was also working in a lot of hospitals and nursing homes, and it was mainly a female staff. Like,
right.
And like, I love, you know, I'm like, yeah, when I was with the all males, it was just, it was toxic. I'm not saying this to like pander. I swear to God, I'm not. It's just the truth. All boys, it was just a little rough.
Yeah.
So we went, we were like, we want to keep this band going because we like the momentum was there and we liked what we were doing and the imagination and everything. So we started going to coffee shops. Like, let's find a female singer in a coffee shop that like has really cute ditties and stuff like that, and ask if, and we
did you say cute ditties?
Yeah, well, nice ditties. Firm high ditties. Ditties that reach to the sky with their inspiration. And we found someone. I'll never forget. I was lying on a couch. I was watching, it was the first season of, what's that? Oh my God, with Simon Cowell and Randy Jackson and Paula Abdul.
Oh God, yeah.
American Idol?
American Idol. I was watching the first season of American Idol. I fell asleep, woke up, and my guitarist, Phil, who's now my business partner in the bar, he was like, I think I found what we're looking for, dog. And, It was this girl, Angela, who was 19. She had gone to Quencher's Saloon underage. Quencher's is a famous bar that doesn't exist anymore.
I have a shirt.
You got a Quencher's shirt?
Yeah.
It was open mic night there. And he's like, I got her number. She wants to jam with us. And we jammed with her. And it was like magic.
Nice.
And we're like, well, let's just keep doing this. And what we said, we're like, but at that, him and I and our drummer at the time, we were like, we want to do this now. Like, we got a little bit of a taste of what it was like. We all like music. We were getting better as musicians. So we kind of were like, let's concentrate on being famous, for lack of a better term. I don't think we said famous, but let's try to like be professional musicians where this is all we need to do. I remember there was a Super Bowl party that we were at, and there was a Mogwai song in the Super Bowl show, and it was a big controversy because everyone was like, Mogwai sold out. And I was like, I don't know if they sold out. They're just getting paid. Like, why not get paid to be in a band? Like, I always kind of thought the sellout thing was like, kind of, there's selling out where you change what you're doing, and then there's selling out where like you're doing what you do and get paid for it.
Yeah.
Yeah, if you become popular for doing what you do and you get hired to do what you do, then how is that selling out?
I don't think it is.
Yeah. I mean, in a lot of it, I think people get, you know, making money is selling out.
Right.
The thing about just being organized and presenting yourself and figuring out how to reach the largest audience, how to sell them things. And the thing is, yeah, when it comes time, is there a point where you need to make a decision to say, do I change what I'm doing enough to sell more?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's where you start getting into it. But being business savvy and marketing yourself has nothing to do with selling out.
But eventually, as we will get to in this sad, tragic tale, that does happen.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's hear it, man. I'm freaking loving this.
So we started writing songs. It was Bill, Phil, and Angela, and like we all loved one another, and it was a fast, like, lovey-dovey. We were going to name ourselves Sybaris, which is a funny story. Sybaris is a sex hotel. Sybaris is a sex hotel in Chicago, and a lot of the people I worked with were always like taking their mistresses and stuff. Like, they were like, oh, I'm taking my girl to the Sybaris. They didn't say Sybaris. They said Sybaris. So I'm like, Sybaris is going to be, and this is how wacky we got. Like, it was the early days of the internet. You put Sybaris into a search engine and there's nothing. It brought nothing. Zero at that time. This was 2003. Yeah. Or Ask Jeeves.
Yes. And I was just going to say that. Ask Jeeves.
So it just was like nothing. But then we found out Sybaris was actually a city in, it was Greece at the time, but it's on the east end of Italy. It's now a city called Bari. It's down towards the heel. And it was like the Sodom and Gomorrah of the Greek Empire. I think they killed like Socrates or something like that. And the one of the tribes or something, like, they buried the whole city, and it wasn't discovered until the early 70s, like, because it was on a swamp and they had dams and stuff like that to keep it away, so they drowned it. So it's like, wow, this is a fucking awesome story.
Yeah,
what a backstory. Not only is it a fuck hotel in the suburbs of Chicago, but it's also the Sodom and Gomorrah of the Greek Empire.
Nice.
We've got ourselves a band name.
Yeah.
And the alternate was Friendship, because we all loved one. Sybaris won out. Turns out there are two bands called Friendship since then. One was a 70s band, and another is like, there's an active band right now called Friendship. So Friendship, aka Sybaris, made a 3-song demo in July of 2003. And we just took a cute, you know, band photo and mailed it out to a bunch of places. And we got like immediately... people were like, so some of the people I were in bands with previously started being bands that were, and everyone started to like kind of take off, and people were like, holy shit, you guys are going to be on a major label. Like, it like clicked with people fast. So all of a sudden we were like, we only had like 4 songs, and they were asking us to open up for like touring bands and stuff, and we only had 4 songs. So it forced us to like write. we kind of sucked. They threw us in front of like 100 people and we weren't ready for it. I remember we were like so slow. Like we had to like eventually listen to recordings of them. We're like, holy shit, we need to like do these at like double time. Like what is wrong with us? But and we started taking off. And we started booking our own tours and we recorded an album. We got it on a local label called Flame Shovel. And we recorded it. You know that label?
No, it just sounded cool.
Flame Shovel. They had a lot of great bands. They had there's a band now that's actually really big that was on Flame Shovel. And they also had these guys that were in these like super formative emo bands, like the guys from Joan of Arc were on this record label too. So we put it out, and when we sent it out to the press release, we ended up getting an 8.0 on Pitchfork. And at the time, that's when Pitchfork, like, if you got a good review on Pitchfork, it meant that, like, you know, Pitchfork Pitchfork was not kind to a lot of bands.
Right.
They tore people apart. They gave them, like, 4.0s. They gave, like, big bands 4.0s. And if you got, like, anything over a 6... It was like, holy shit, you guys have, and then we got an 8.0.
That's awesome.
And then things just kind of started steamrolling, and then we got a...
It was in Cleveland, right? Cleveland steamrolling?
The Cleveland steamer!
You're a Cleveland steamrolling.
That was also a band, a name that was in the running.
Really?
It wasn't. But I'll tell you this much. That's the kind of thing that when you were in the band with the guys, you just sat around and
you're right.
Say things like that. Yeah.
You would make up new things. There was one called The Shark. Like everyone would just make up these violent, like sexual things that made no sense. And one was The Shark. And it's like a girl will be performing fellatio, bite your penis off, stick it on the back of her back like it's a shark fin, and then run around the room with blood in her mouth going, I'm a shark.
I've actually never heard of that
because we made it up in the band.
Oh, okay,
that's why I'm saying I don't want to be in a band with guys anymore. Maybe it was the moment that the shark happened.
You jumped the shark.
Yes, we jumped the shark.
Exactly.
You Elena Bobbitted the shark.
Yes. I was just like, I can't do this anymore. Turns out girls are just as bad. Who are we joking?
If it was a van full of girls, they would probably be just as bad.
Well, I've heard stories about the Go-Go's that they used to do horrible things. Like, I don't know if they're true or not, but I've heard rumors that the Go-Go's used to do the same thing. So we did this album. And everyone thought it was great. And everyone was like, these guys are going to be the next big thing. The booking agent of one of the big clubs here in Chicago, I actually got in his face when I was drunk in a blackout at a show and cussed him out that said, you don't fucking do anything for local bands. And one of his interns I knew sent me a text message like, dude, you got in Sean's face. And like, he's really pissed off. And so I'm like, I sent him, I'm like, oh man, we're going to get blackballed. So I sent him I saw that.
Oh no, that's.
Are you trying to mute me?
No. We can hear Andy. Carl can hear Andy. And I'm like, that's easy. We'll just hit.
So I got in this guy's face in a blackout. I don't even remember doing it. And I was like, you don't do anything for local band. And one of his assistants was like, dude, he's so pissed off at you. He thinks you're a fucking piece of shit, blah, blah, blah. And so I had to write this long apology. I'm so sorry. But I was also like, but what have you done for me lately? And he responded back. He's like, because you got in my face, I listened to your demo. And he's like, holy shit, you guys are the fucking best. And he hooked us up with one of the biggest booking agents, managers in the music industry. Okay. So all of a sudden we had this big booking agent who's big. It was a big deal. And then all of a sudden, our friends that were in bands were just like, how the fuck did this happen? So we started getting a little hate.
Oh, really?
A little bit. Yeah. And
why were your friends in bands better than
I don't know if they're better. No. Honestly, like, I really, at this point, was like, I think we're really, like, it kind of became like a self-actualized band. Like, I'm doing everything. Because I like, I have a soft spot for pop music. And we were kind of combining everything. It was like, it was poppy. There was shoegaze elements. There was heavy metal elements. There was post-punk elements. Like, we're a post-punk shoegaze pop metal band with a that's female
fucking awesome.
That's fronted by a female. And I love like female vocalists. I was like super proud. And I like had some problems at this point. Like, it was a lot of pressure. All of a sudden we were like kind of hot shit, for lack of a better term, but we weren't, but we kind of were.
Right.
I don't know how to even explain this. This is kind of feel like I'm in therapy right now, because I knew we weren't hot shit. And in the big picture, compared to like Coldplay or Nirvana, like, or even at the time Fall Out Boy was in Chicago and Alkaline right. Trio and stuff like that. Like, we weren't anything compared to them, but the potential was there. And then there was like a lot of other bands that this was pre-internet. This was pre like file sharing and Spotify and stuff like that. You still had to get your music out. It was still about your live show and stuff like that, just on the border of that. And so the pressure kind of like, and we worked super hard to get to this point, and the pressure got bad. And I would like, I had some like, I would get drunk and run my mouth off. I ran my mouth off into some bad things. So all of a sudden I was like the bad guy. But people really liked our lead singer because she's super sweet and stuff. And I was like, what are you doing playing music with this non-talented? And then people just straight up tell me I was had no talent.
Ouch.
A lot. I got to hear that a lot. I got to hear that from my friends. People that I thought would get drunk that were like my friends. Like, you guys like are hacks. And
you know what's weird is this like a different vibe? Like, if you're an artist, you're, like, doing it yourself. I mean, I'm sure a lot of people think I have no fucking talent, but nobody's going to tell it to me. But if you're in a band, nobody's afraid to tell you you have no talent. You know, it's, like, fucking crazy. No.
A guy that I used to get my bass set up by was wasted at one of our shows, and he had the glass-eyed, wasted look. And he goes, you should never touch a bass again.
Oh, jeez.
Ouch. Dude, that's brutal.
Totally brutal. I read a review from, and they were like, the bass player needs to, the bass player, because our music was kind of serious. It said the bass player provided needed comic relief to take the edge off the seriousness of the music, but he seriously needs to go take some lessons to learn how to play his instrument.
But hey, at least somebody, you got reviewed, you know, like.
And the comments on, we did like a national TV show where we played, and just the comments were like about all of us, because none of us were really that good. We always have had a good drummer. We went through three drummers and we always had great drummers. But like the comment sections were fucking horrific.
But I know like the Violent Femmes didn't know how to play their instruments, and I don't know if they got like bad reviews or
certain
anything.
Things got me through this, and one of them was I read a story that like Kurt Cobain, this ties into our second album too, because we recorded our second album at Pachyderm Studios, which is where In Utero was recorded. So we recorded our album there. I think PJ Harvey's Rhythm Me was recorded there. A lot of like early 90s class. And that was kind of the sound we were going for.
PJ Harvey is like Boston famous, definitely. Like, I mean, probably more than Boston famous, but.
I remember the story about Chris Novoselic had to like tune. It was Steve Albini told the story that Chris Novoselic needed to tune Kurt Cobain's guitar because he didn't know how to tune a guitar. Like, there's a difference between, and this is like with artistic edge, like, you can be a good songwriter and write a good song like with just your voice or patting on a table.
Right.
Or with one string on a guitar where you go up and down. The one of the moments where I decided I wanted to be in a band was I saw this band Polvo, which is still one of my favorite bands. And the opening band was called Ilium. It was John Hughes's son. And I remember watching, I was in the front row, and I remember the guy had one finger. I don't know whether it was the guitar or bass. And he just went down and up and was playing. I'm like, anyone can do this. So in my mind, I was like, you know what? I'm a good songwriter. These songs are good. I'm a songwriter. I'm an arranger. I may not be the greatest musician of all time, but some of these great, like, I don't want to put on a Steve Vai album or an Yngwie Malmsteen album
right.
and listen to those guys wank. I'll listen to bands that obviously, like, I'll listen to Einstürz und die Neubauten, which is guys banging on pots and pans.
Right.
Before I'll listen to Steve Vai. So, yeah, I mean, it was hurtful and it was stressful. And, like, to this day, I still think about that stuff.
But you're true Archhead, man. This is all about, this is what the Archhead's about, man. You're true Archhead.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank
that,
you.
That really is, I mean, like, the definition of punk is starting a band, even if you can't play the instruments. And I think, and like I said, I think a lot of that came out of the spirit of basically the garage bands of the 60s. But that shouldn't matter. I mean, you can take time and learn how to play. But like the Mekons, no one knew what they were playing when they first formed in 77. And they're still around, like, whatever, 30-something years later.
They were big in the scene, like, when I first started playing. Like, they were probably at their pinnacle. They were playing at Lounge Axe, and Lounge Axe was our mecca.
Yeah.
At the time.
Hey, can you talk to us about touring? Like what was, like, some crazy shit that happened while you were touring?
Well, when we first started touring, we booked our own tours. And that was magical. I will tell you, to this day, those are some of the best days of my life. Because we booked our own tours off of the demo, and people would let us play there, and then they would get local bands to play with us, and we met so many cool people in Lowell that I'm still friends with to this day, that I'm pretty tight friends with a couple people, some people in Austin, and we toured the country twice just on our own booking.
Nice.
And it was super magical and fun. Some crazy stuff that happened, boy, oof.
What's the best one? You got one?
I don't know.
No, I didn't. No worries.
Let me think. They'll come to me.
Yeah, right. Of course, they'll come to you. We're actually closing in. We got like 10 minutes left.
Yeah, about 5 more minutes, and then we transition to the next episode.
Then we can go for the next episode. We'll do another episode. We'll take a break. But
I mean, we've been talking about music this whole time. Do you want to like, do you still play in bands, or do you want to talk about you haven't played in like 10 years?
Part of the tragedy is, like, I literally had a breakdown because of where we got built up so high, and then it crashed.
Yeah.
And we saw people that, like, we used to tour with, friends of ours. Like, I saw two friends of mine 2 weeks in a row on Saturday Night Live while I was sitting in my apartment watching them, like, wasted, crying, like, this should be me. Like, I did not handle it at all.
So,
oh, man.
Like, talk to us.
I'm not looking for sympathy or anything like that. I was totally mismanaged expectations on my part. We had such a good time and probably got further than 90% of all bands, let alone friends bands and stuff like that, that I feel like a complete cunt acting the way and feeling the way I did. But everything's relative.
Right.
Right.
But it's kind of like you were at a place where you could taste the, like, we're almost there. We're at the cusp.
The brass ring, they call it.
Yeah.
So tell us about that. Like, the pin, we need, like, this story to, like,
that's not even there yet, though. We're not, like, at this point, we're still self-touring. All
right, let's get there. I don't care if we go a little over, we can cut off Chris, we can cut off some of the front, but, like, let's get there, man.
So we self-toured, and then we got, like, the big booking agent, and then we were to record our next album.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of screwed over our record label and jumped to another record label that offered us more money. Went with this big booking agent, and that's, like, we were like, all right, we're going to fucking do this. And that's where everything went great and also bad at the same time. Because we got in bed with, like, corporate music, and there was pressure to, like, got to put out a hit. And that really happened. It was
they came to you and they said, all right, now you have to make a hit.
Yeah. You gotta have.
Did they like be like, do something like these guys, or?
Kinda, yeah.
Was it like, have a cigar, you're gonna go
far? Yes, it was.
Yeah.
It was. I listened to that fucking album, Welcome the Machine, and think about that. On a certain level, it was. It's, come in here, dear boy, have like a hit off this joint, not have a cigar. It was way more indie and punk rock.
Right.
But I was dealing with people that were booking bands that were like selling out huge venues.
You're never going to die. You're going to make it if you try.
They're going to love you.
Yeah.
So then what happened, man?
It didn't happen is what happened. We recorded our second album and then the world happened. Like the digital music started happening. MySpace happened and we couldn't keep up with the MySpace because at that point, like our lead singer was 20, 21 and she was a Luddite. She didn't want anything to do with technology and we were in our 30s and we were getting all of a sudden come in these bands that were like 22 year olds, 18, 19 that have been like diddling on fucking like coding and stuff like that. And they're boom getting their like cute songs out. And like, we could not keep up with like technology. It sounds like an excuse, but like, it's just a fact. Like we couldn't keep up. We were supposed to like, spend hours a day on MySpace trying to find other bands that sound like us and like posting our songs on and like, right. And we didn't know how to make bots to do that for us. So it was like, I was getting up in the morning and like going to the Yeah Yeah Yeahs and Interpol's pages and posting our songs. And it was rough, man. And then like people just, the album came out and it got a 7.5 on Pitchfork and we had all these big tours. Like, so in between the first album and the second album, we played Lollapalooza and we played Lollapalooza at like,
no way.
Yeah. At like 1 o'clock in the afternoon on the PlayStation stage. Like we had a money spot.
Yeah.
Nice.
Like I've got pictures of us playing on Washington Avenue and you could see the,
right.
Yeah, we were hanging out with all the big bands and stuff like that. It was great. And then the next year, we played the Virgin Music Festival. Like, we're sitting next to Bjork, like, watching Bjork. Like
did she have the swan thing on her?
They were wearing, like, hoodies and stuff like that. And then they went on stage and played, like, yeah, but we're hanging out with, like,
that's so cool.
All these big bands backstage. Like, and then the year after that, our album came out and we were booked to play the Austin City Limits Festival.
Oh, cool.
Which is just like, it's made by the same, it's on Lollapalooza South.
Yeah.
Right.
The Foo Fighters headlined it. And our album came out and got they didn't sell it. It came out, we got no press. It was really depressing. And they put us on, the gates opened at 11 and they put us on at 11:30. There was like nobody there. There was like 50, it was like our friends were there and it was embarrassing. Like nobody wanted to do interviews with us. You could tell that like they like, but it was booked a year in advance and it was super shitty.
Yeah, that sucks.
So if it was a year earlier, it might've been different.
If the album didn't tank. We also went to South by Southwest and our record release party had like nobody at it. Like there was no press at it. There was no, it was like, wow, this is our record release party. And it was like, everyone went into panic mode. Our like record label and booking agent was like, nobody came to your fucking record release. Nobody,
right,
gives,
but
a, nobody gives a shit about you guys. Like, and it was like, how the fuck did this happen? Like, did we
how
take
much of
much?
That is, your fault, and that, like, shouldn't the record label be like totally promoting you guys?
We had a publicist, and I don't know. There's plenty of blame to go around. It could be the album just wasn't that great. We did a video. I sent you guys a video. We thought the video was great.
Yeah.
All our friends said they liked it.
Yeah.
My mom said I'm cool.
Nice.
My mom said she liked it. I don't know. It just didn't. It tanked. It didn't go anywhere. That's the fact. It didn't sell anything. They printed out. I've got cases of it sitting at the bar right now.
Nice.
Cases of this album.
No harm, no foul there, brother. I mean, shit happens.
Shit happens. Yeah. But I got to keep saying to myself, look at what we did. Look what we did. We played Lollapalooza. We played so I'm from Cleveland. We played something called the Cuyahoga Music Festival. It was at Blossom Music Center. Yeah. It's where I saw Roger Waters, the Psychedelic Furs, Depeche Mode, all these bands when I was growing up. That's where we used to go. I saw Lollapalooza one there with Nine Inch Nails and Jane's Addiction. I was there playing on that. Like,
oh yeah, I did. I saw Lollapalooza one too. Also,
so you And I'm like, I got to do this. Like, why am I being such a fucking baby?
Right?
Why am I not being grateful?
Did you meet anybody like Perry Farrell or anything like that?
Because of Lollapalooza that we played, and I had a broken leg while we were playing, he like walked by me and said, "Hey, man." The best people I hung out with at Lollapalooza was the guys from Coheed and Cambria. They came and like hung out with me because I had a broken foot and felt bad for me. And like hung out with me. And then I actually, by one of the guys that works at my bar is a guitar tech and got me backstage at Coheed and Cambria and Mastodon last 2019. And they're like, "You're the dude with the broken foot." I'm like, "That was like 11 years ago. How do you remember me?" That's awesome. So yeah, I mean, it was a beautiful time, but I had to go to therapy and stuff. Like, I was such a spoiled brat that I couldn't believe it flopped. And then like my world started to like spiral, and I was like, "What am I doing with my life?" And so like I wanted to have a kid real bad. So I was like, "Who wants to get pregnant?"
Wow.
And like I had a kid, and we still kept trying to do the band, and we wrote a fucking great album. And my best friend from like, we didn't have a record label anymore. Like all record labels collapsed. So we were record label-less and nobody cared about us. So my best friend has a music studio in my hometown, and we recorded this album that fucking slaps, and we had nowhere to put it out. And it's just sitting there and no one's heard it. Like 20 people have heard it. It just happened. That's what happened. That's got really fast forwarded there. We spent a lot of time front ending it, but it happened that quick. One day we thought we were going to be on top of the world, and the next day we were like, "Well, we're not." And it's weird, you know, like the proud of the music and stuff like that. Why do I care whether it was commercially successful and stuff like that? Like, I shouldn't. And now I don't. Now that I'm older, I don't care. But that's it. I don't know what to say.
I mean it's a great story, man. I mean, you guys you're hanging out with Jane's Addiction. I mean, what more can you ask?
Yeah, you got to have so many amazing experiences.
That's why I'm not ungrateful. I wouldn't go back in time at all. Now that I like bartend at my bar and I see these young kids and bands and stuff like that, and they're like so hopeful and stuff like that, I do have a little bit of like mixed emotions. Sometimes I want to just be like, "Give up now, losers." But I don't feel that. I totally don't feel that at all. Like, that was just me being funny. But like,
so I mean, like, that's funny, but I mean, I really think you have to like strive for, I mean, as far as you can go when you're younger. Because, like, no, you know, like, that's it. I mean, you got to roll the fucking dice, right?
Yeah. Man?
I mean, like, it seems like you did. You rolled the dice, and you know, you got a fucking, like, you didn't get a 1. You didn't get a 20. No. You got maybe a 14.
I did.
You know, on a 20-sided dice, I'm talking.
Exactly. We did.
And that's better than most rolls, man.
We actually got to make a module, a 3.5 module, complete with artists that did D&D, and it was about our music, and it was a EP.
You're kidding.
I'll send it to you. We have an EP that's a old school, like, first edition module, but it's D20, and it's like, we wrote 3 songs about Dungeons & Dragons, like, and it was all paid for.
Oh my God, that's fucking success right there, dude.
Yeah,
I know.
Is that Voyage of the Stag Party?
That is Voyage of the Stag Party. You know about it?
No. I'm looking on the Googles, and I see it.
Voyage of the Stag Party.
Okay. I thought it was just a random Google image, And then you mentioned it. I was like, oh, crap, that's your actual thing you're just talking about right now.
Yeah. And the guy who recorded that is one of the like best engineers in the heavy metal business. It was like, yeah, we got to work with all these great engineers and make a D&D module. Like, I mean, it's great. I love my life.
It is.
I'm 100% big fan of my life and proud of everything I've done and extremely grateful.
That's how it is, man.
But I
like dude, but here's the thing, like the whole thing is like the grandfather on the deathbed and the breakup girl with your girlfriend at the same time. You know what I mean? Like this whole podcast, that's what I love that, like that description of the song you made. That's insane.
I got that on SoundCloud. I'll send you the link to it on SoundCloud.
That's so fucked up.
Cool. Yeah, we'll post that. We'll post that to the
All right, so we're about at the end. Chris is going to have to Chris claimed that he's going to edit this. He's going to have to go at the front end and cut a little bit out of the front end because we got rolling like really good towards the end, I think.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Okay, so let's everybody Sean, talk about
Sean. Do you? Oh, sorry.
Oh, go ahead, Andy.
Go ahead. Yeah. Sean, do you have any like links or things you want to promote, or you know, tell people where they can? I know you're not playing that much anymore, but
no,
if you want to
really
unload some
you
albums,
could do the SoundCloud. I mean, you could do the Spotify of Sybaris, I guess. Okay.
And then you also, we'll talk about this more in the next episode, but you have a food truck and a bar, right?
Yeah, and all that stemmed from, all that came out of the band.
Right.
Like I'm partners with my bandmate.
We can start that in the next episode. You can start about the band, like your band ending in the food truck. Why don't we talk about that next time, next episode.
I dig it.
Okay, yeah. Cool. All right. So where can they find you?
The music?
Yeah.
And
whatever you want to promote.
Yeah, I would just go to, you could go to S-Y-B-R-I-S is how you spell it. We took the A out of it, so it's not Sybaris. S-Y-B-R-I-S at Spotify. We got some videos, live footage up on YouTube. We have some stuff on SoundCloud, some unreleased stuff on SoundCloud.
That's awesome, man.
And if you want to like look at what we're doing in the food and beverage industry now, it's donerman.com, donerman.com. And like on Instagram, we're Demon Tap Shy.
That's cool. I like it.
But it all ties in. I mean, it's directly flows into one another.
Awesome.
Nice. Well, we continue the story next episode.
We're going to continue this. Chris, where are you?
I'm a Live Fire Cook on Instagram, livefirecook.com. If it's Live Fire Cook online, it's probably me.
Andy?
I am at andyrestino.com, and you can find links to my YouTube, Twitter, Instagram, all that jazz there.
I'm at madcarl.com. Carl Restaino on Instagram, Carl Restaino on Facebook. And you don't have to stay here, but you have to get the fuck out of here. So get the hell out of your shit!
Thanks to Sean Podgorski, I hope I'm pronouncing that right, for being on the shed. Thanks to Carl and Chris for helping host the show. Thanks to all our listeners and other listeners for listening to the show. This has been Welcome to the Art Shed. See you all next time.
Peace out.
Thanks to Andy Sinispago and Ed Guild for the Matt Carl Stomp.